questions.
Just combing the hair on a billiard ball.
The hairy ball theorem. So you didn't look at the wiki page, huh?
I didn't. I wanted you to elaborate as much as you could.
I don't. Not sure I feel like elaborating. So. Yeah, so if you, so this comes up in the context of radiation from a spherically symmetric source. So if there were radiation from a spherically symmetric source, there would be light that was perpendicular to, because there would be an electric field that would be perpendicular to any sphere, right? Because in order to propagate out, you have to have a perpendicular electric field. So if you looked at all of the electric fields in a sphere that's surrounding your source, you can think of them as kind of like your hairs. And obviously, like you comb your hairs, if you have a nearby point, the electric field is going to point in a nearby direction. And so the question is, can you do that in a spherically symmetric fashion? Can you have the hair that would kind of go around a sphere symmetrically? And the answer is no, right? You know from parting. You're going to have a part in your hair at some point. You can't have a spherically symmetric pattern of hair on a ball. And if you Google hairy ball theorem, we've discovered, you discover even a wiki page that explains all of this.
Just wanted that on tape.
Tapes can be erased. 18 minute gaps and all of that. Okay. Other questions? So kind of the point from last time is to try and leverage your understanding about how rotations work to how boosts work. So this word boost means a change in frames of reference going from one that is at rest to one that is moving. Although, of course, the concept of at rest is meaningless. So frames that are in relative motion, I guess I should say. And, of course, it's a hard sell, right? Because while I'm sure you can believe that I can take a point and by choosing different coordinate systems make the x number, the x coordinate, be just about anything I want, it's kind of hard to believe that by changing my reference frame I could make time run any different from how I want. I mean, how could I get different time coordinates? So we have this perception that goes presumably, you know, back to the apes, certainly includes Newton, that time is some sort of absolute, that it's not changeable. And my trickery is to hope to convince you that you can change time. That time can be changed just like any other coordinate by changing your frame of reference. And we make that kind of visual with these Minkowski diagrams. So the setup then is that, so first of all, rewriting this word vector, really what we're talking about are tensors, things that have transformation properties. And seemingly by choosing a different frame of reference, we can get almost any number you want for the coordinates of a particular physical point. The numbers that describe that physical point vary according to what coordinate frame you're in. And if we want to go between coordinate frames, we use a rotation matrix in this case, and we can calculate the new coordinates based on the previous coordinates. Some quantities are invariant, they're the same. So things like mass, time according to Newton, temperature, those things don't seem to change according to when you rotate the coordinate systems. And you can't just put together any old three things and call it a vector, right? So if I take, my weight and your weight and your weight, I've got three numbers, but if I rotate the coordinate systems, I don't suddenly become thin. So I said that dot products were invariant, and it's going to be helpful to kind of see how that works. If we want to be mathematicians and make the dot product be something that's mathematical, what we need to do is to convert a column vector which is our normal vector, into a row vector so that we can then use normal matrix multiplication. So transpose is the name of the thing that switches around the rows and columns of a matrix. This is a pretty simple matrix that has just one column and three rows. If I take the transpose of it, I get a matrix that has one row and three columns. And then I can nicely do the usual sort of matrix multiplication and thereby generate the dot product. So if we see how this works in general, what we end up with if we're going to make the dot product invariant, then the transpose of that matrix times the matrix has to be the unit matrix. And the name of those set of matrices where the inverse is the transpose are called orthogonal matrices. And it's going to work exactly the same way in relativity, where here we have an invariant form that is just like the dot products. It's the sum of the coordinates squared, except we trickily put an I in one of our coordinates to generate this minus sign. And we know this quantity has to be invariant because light looks like a sphere no matter what coordinate system you're in, right? So you might guess that if you're in a moving coordinate system, if you were moving along with the light, that it would be closer to one edge than the other edge. But because of the way time gets reworked, it still looks like it's a sphere surrounding about that the point where it flashed from. So now we have what we're going to call an event, which is something that has four coordinates, space and time coordinates. And the idea is that this Minkowski diagram allows you to kind of read those coordinates off more or less automatically. So if we look at these diagrams, the usual XY coordinates allow, we can read those off directly. So for example, you know, this point would correspond roughly to x equals 2 and ct equals to, excuse me, x equals to 1 and ct equal to 2. We'd also like to be able to read off those coordinates kind of automatically in a boosted frame. And we can do that by reading off our coordinates on these diagonal lines. So to figure out where this is in terms of x prime, well, the frame is moving forward, so the x is going to be less than it would be otherwise. And this is going to be these set of points are going to be x prime equals 1, and these set of points are the origin, there where x prime equals 0. So instead of x being 1, it's a little bit less than 1. And we read off various times along these axes. So this is the set of points that is t prime equal to 0. This is the set of points that have t prime equal to 1. So this time looks to be a little bit less than 2 in the prime coordinate system. So pick your favorite point, and I can tell what the primed and unprimed coordinates are of this point. I've, of course, suppressed the y and z because it's hard to draw things in four dimensions. Okay, and we talked about this diagram in terms of proving the usual sorts of standard features of relativity. Lorentz contraction, time dilation, and lack of synchronization, which is obvious in the fact that t prime equals 0 is not a horizontal line. Questions about Minkowski diagrams? So kind of another way of looking at it, and I think that it's, I mean, you kind of have to come to believe this one way or the other, is this diagram, which also shows two frames of reference, but it shows them in what you might call the center of mass frame. So instead of seeing the prime frame at rest, we see the prime frame is moving along in the positive x direction. And the unprime frame is moving just as fast in the other direction. And so we're in the kind of the midpoint frame. And quite naturally, because moving clocks aren't synchronized, these digital clocks, which all would click at the same moment according to the primed observer, they don't seem to be reading all the same time to us. Right? So this leading clock seems to be running behind, and this leading clock seems to be running ahead. So this is independent of time dilation. This is just the digits don't change at the same time. And I think it's useful, that's why it's a homework problem, to go through this and see how it is possible that when the primed coordinates look at one of these clocks in the unprimed coordinate system, they say it's running slow, and vice versa. When somebody in the unprimed frame looks at a clock in the prime frame, he says it's running slow. And similarly, how the prime guy says that all of this distance just fits between these two areas, so there must be some sort of Lorentz contraction, and exactly the same thing is said by the unprimed frame. And you can see that the kind of the reason this all works is because of lack of synchronization. People don't agree about what at the same time means, and as a result, measurements that might sound the same, like how long does it take a clock to click, actually occur at different events in the space-time continuum. Any questions about all of that stuff, which I would guess is all stuff that you learned and forgot about from modern? Okay, so once we realize that what we want are four vectors, the question is going to be, how do we make four vectors?
Why do we want vectors?
So we wanted to have vectors so that we could write one equation and we know it would be true in any rotated coordinate system. The reason we want four vectors is we want to write equations that are going to be true for moving observers and not moving observers, for everyone. So the only way we can be sure that the equations of physics are going to look the same to moving and non-moving observers if they're written in some sort of four-vector form. Okay, so we want four vectors for the same reason we wanted vectors. We wanted to immediately demonstrate that things were independent of frame. Okay, so we always start with one vector, right? We have the R vector if we're talking about three-dimensional space, and we have this vector that has four components that are RCT if we're talking about this in terms of four-dimensional space. Now there's kind of a problem with notation, which there isn't a standard solution to, and everyone just forgets about the problem as they grow up. For vectors, when we're doing this on the blackboard, we put little arrows on things, and when we do it in typeface, we use a bold for R. So it would be nice also to have some sort of definite notation for what a four vector is that would distinguish it from anything else. And we don't really want to repeat the bold because I want to write things like this, where a four vector includes a three vector. So I really need a new symbol for it. And the world has established boldface for vectors. There is no establishment for what to use for four vectors. Our book uses, I think it's called Faktur, this kind of funny script. I think it has German origins for their four vectors. You can imagine what it would look like if I tried to draw those. So what I like to use is things that have a doubled bar in them. So that's a four vector X. And I don't know if I'll keep with this notation for long periods of time or not. And typically, when we were talking about vectors, we might have said that the Y component of the R vector was R sub 2. And if we were talking generically, we usually used letters like IJK. So now we're going to have, say, x sub 2 being y. And if we're going to talk about a generic component of x, we usually use a Greek letter like mu. And we're still playing the Einstein summation notation game so that repeated Greek or IJK letters are indicating automatically sums. Okay, so name a vector. How did we go from the vector R to some other sort of vector in three-dimensional space in 191? Say again?
Did we make it out of components? Yeah. So, name another vector from 191.
Any vector.
Unless I don't like it. Say again?
The velocity.
Velocity vector is fine. How do we make a velocity vector? And how are we sure that it's a vector? We're sure that R is a vector. How are we sure that the velocity is a vector? Say again? Well, I can take our three weights and claim that it has magnitude and direction. So the only possible answer has to be based on R, because that's the only thing we know for sure transforms according to these rotation matrices. And in fact, what we did for this velocity vector is we took changes in positions, which are vectors, and we divided it by what I said was an invariant. Newton claimed that time was an invariant. It was the same in any frame. So that's guaranteed then to be a vector, because it's a vector divided by an invariant. Well, you need some reason for it to be a vector. I'm tempted to say yes to that, but then maybe you're going to ask me about electric and magnetic fields. So I'm going to be silent about that. Okay, so if we want to make something like a velocity for a vector, we're going to start with some change in the four velocity components. But we now need to divide by an invariant. And we know that time is an invariant, right? Pick a different frame, you're going to get a different delta t. So the overall idea, though, is that if we have two events that are separated a little bit in time and space, we can calculate an invariant that is delta x squared plus delta y squared plus delta z squared minus c delta t squared. Right? That's exactly the dot product of two vectors, and we know that it's invariant. So I want to make something that looks like time that is related to that. So why don't I take the square root of delta t squared minus 1 over c squared delta r squared? Yeah, I'm trying to do this. So in order to make the way we made vectors in 191 was by taking the only vector we knew, r, and dividing it by invariants. And so we've got a delta x, that's good, but now we need an invariant to divide it by in order to make a new vector. And delta t isn't invariant, it changes according to your frame. So I can't use delta t. But what I can use is this combination. That is invariant. If I pick a new set of frames, I'll get a different value for delta t, a different value for delta r, but I'll get exactly the same quantity here, because this is really a dot product, and dot products are invariant. So this is delta t. Okay, and this is all coming from the idea that r squared minus c squared t squared is invariant, except I put deltas in there and divided it all by c squared to get something that had the units of time as opposed to space.
What was that first term?
Say again?
What's the first term? Delta?
Delta t. So, since you can't read my handwriting, you don't want me to ever do that again. So, what I want to do is give that a name, and I'm going to call that d proper time. So we often use the word proper to describe things that are in the rest frame. And so if our two positions that we're comparing are in fact at the same location, then what we're going to have is a proper time that's equal to the normal time. Okay? Okay, so if we crank away a little bit at this, we can make this into a little bit more familiar form. If I pull out a delta t from underneath the radical, I'm going to get the square root of 1 minus 1 over c squared delta r squared divided by delta t squared. And this, of course, we recognize as the usual 3 velocity. And the square root, I hope you recognize, is related to gamma. So this is delta t divided by gamma. Okay, where again, gamma is the one over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. And v squared over c squared we'd usually call beta squared. Okay, so that's going to be my 4 velocity vector. It's equal to dx divided by the invariant, that is d tau. And we see that dd tau is actually gamma times ddt, and the four position vector is r and ict. So what I'm going to get for my 4 velocity vector is gamma times the normal velocity, the normal 3 velocity, and if I take the derivative of time with respect to time, I just get 1. Now, back in three-dimensional space, we were often concerned about the speed, right? The v without the arrow on it, which was the square root of the dot product, and hence it was invariant. What's the speed of my 4 vector? So if I take the dot product of the 4 vector with itself, I'm going to get gamma squared, velocity squared, and then I'm going to get minus c squared, minus because of this I. And I'm not sure if you can see where this is going, but if I pull out a minus sign and a c squared, so I've got c squared, gamma squared, 1 minus v squared over c squared, that's equal to c squared. So the 4 velocity speed is a constant, even for something that's at rest. Everything has a 4 velocity speed that is c. Sometimes that 4 velocity is pointed in a spatial direction, so we've got a big speed, 3-dimensional speed. Sometimes that 4 velocity is oriented in the time direction, in which case I could be at rest. But all my 4 velocities have the same magnitude. Okay, so we could go on and take accelerations if we wanted to. What's another way that we have of making vectors in 191? No other vectors in 191? Acceleration would just be taking another derivative. So I'm looking for a new way. And it's fine. We can talk about a 4 acceleration too. And actually, it's somewhat amusing to think about the 4 acceleration. It's not that amusing. Well, yes, it is. It is. It's pretty amusing. So under what conditions is the 3 acceleration perpendicular to the 3 velocity, right? That's centripetal acceleration, where you have something that's going in a circle. And that's the way it always is in relativity, in some sense, right? Because we have just said that u squared is equal to c, I didn't pull out my minus sign officially, did I? Is equal to minus c squared. And if I just take the derivative of this, so I take dd tau of u squared, I'm going to get, just like I did before, I'm going to get 2u dotted into the 4 acceleration vector, and the derivative of a constant is 0.
So the four acceleration vector is always perpendicular to the velocity vector. And you are amused. At least I am. Any other ways of making vectors? Otherwise, it's going to be pretty dull. We can take derivatives. Well, force vector is equal to a mass times an acceleration, so it's related to a derivative case. Whole chapters are being deleted from 191 as we speak. Probably chapters you didn't like, but they're being deleted. Say again? Yeah. Angular momentum, right? That was a vector. Well, the P was a velocity and the R is a velocity, but this is a new combination of them. It's not a dot product, right? And we also had torques that were R cross F. F was related to derivatives. R we knew as a vector. We claimed that torques were a vector. Well, I think I've told you that cross product is kind of special and it really only applies to three-dimensional space. But it's closely related to something that we've been making vectors out of. Well, maybe I should remember that a vector is a tensor. And things like the quadrupole moment tensor, how did we make those things up? So those things you remember were dyadics, right? We basically just put two vectors next to each other, right? So we said that the matrix was EI and EJ. And if we just put two vectors next to each other, then it's going to transform. We know how it's going to transform, right? We're going to transform this one, we're going to transform that one, we're going to put them together. So just by putting two vectors side by side, we can make something that is going to transform in a well-defined way. So let's first of all talk about that a little bit. If we had a matrix, so this might be a quadrupole moment tensor, it might be a stress energy tensor. We've talked about a handful of tensors, and they're of course matrices. How did that matrix transform? Well, I can tell you this two different ways. So those are I's and J's. So how many remember the word similarity transformation? Nobody. Okay, well then we won't go that way. So if we had a rotation matrix so that R in the new prime system was equal to matrix multiplication, remember matrix multiplication looks like that, where I'm summing on the J, so I'm going down a column and row. If we have something that has two indices, you just do it twice. So that M in the new system, which I might as well call K and L, say, what that's equal to is RKIMI, and then I do exactly the same thing to J, so I have an RLJ. So for every indices, you just use the rotation matrix on it. And that's, of course, perfectly clear that that's what you would do if you had a matrix that was just EI, EJ, right? Obviously, you transform this one and you transform that one. So these R's are rotation matrices.
So are they multiplying? Like, is that supposed to be on the other side of the N, or what is it?
Oh, so this is continued. So there are three things that I'm multiplying together and adding up, of course, because they have repeated indices I and J. Well, let's crank this away a little bit. It would be nice. So right now, this doesn't look this
this is nicely set up to be matrix multiplication, right? Because I have the second index and the first index that are combined. But this and this are not set up to be matrix multiplication. But I could make it be multiplication, matrix multiplication, if I took the transpose of R. Now the second thing is in the first thing, and the first thing is in the second thing because I transform them. So now if I put this together, what I have is R, K, I, M, I, J, R transposed, it's J, N, L matrices. And it all looks exactly like matrix multiplication. So if I think about it that way, it's R times M times R transpose. And remember, for these rotation matrices, the transpose was the inverse. And I claim, perhaps correctly, that when you took linear algebra, you talked about things like this, which were called similarity transformations. If you took group theory, you should have talked about things like this. I can ask. I'm sure you did. Cosets, all that good stuff. You did it. If you took group theory.
I don't think any of us took group theory.
So I communicated with one person, I guess. So another way of making tensors is to just put together two things. And if you think about it, if we try and not write cross products the way we're used to, one way we could think about writing a cross product is we take, say, R, I, P, J, and we subtract off R, J, P, I. Right? Those are the components of the cross product, but we're thinking about it now as a matrix as opposed to something else. So I don't know if I'll get this right or not, but obviously the diagonal elements are going to be zero, and this 1-2 element is probably the angular momentum in the three direction. It is. So we can think about the angular momentum as opposed to being a vector, as being pieces of a 3x3 matrix, of an anti-symmetric 3x3 matrix. So this is another common way of making, if not vectors, at least making tensors, things that have multiple indices.
So angular momentum.
So this you recognize as angular momentum, right? Because that's what the cross product does. It takes 1 and 3 and then 1 and 2 and then subtracts 2 and 1. So what I'm saying is that we think about angular momentum is a perfectly good vector in three-dimensional space, or you can think about it as a piece of a matrix, the off-diagonal elements of a matrix. And it turns out that that is what generalizes to four dimensions. So we can make tensors, things that have multiple indices on them, just by putting things side by side and either bothering to subtract them or not. Any of those things would be perfectly good tensors. Once we got things with lots of indices, another way we can make vectors is by contraction. So, I mean, this is going to sound unlikely to you, but if you had something that had three indices, I could contract two of them, and now I only have one index, and it's got to be a vector. So contraction is another way we can make vectors. We're probably more familiar with that as making scalars, right? So if we take R and R, what we get is the magnitude of R squared, and we know that that's invariant. So by contraction, we can reduce the number of indices that we've got. Okay. So what does all of this have to do with electricity and magnetism? So now that we've learned lots of ways of making vectors, let's start listing the vectors that we can in fact pretty easily make. So we of course have the X vector, right? Ooh, I'm not going to like this color. Which is three components are the R vector, and then we've got CT. Now remember that we had things that were we had four of things multiple times. So one time we had four of things, whereas when we put the vector potential and the voltage divided by C, those things all have the same units and they satisfied the same equation when we were talking about them. So all I need to do is to put an I in there and I've got a perfectly good four vector. Similarly, we had the current, where we had the current and we had the charge density times C. And in order to make this into a four vector, all I need to do is to add an I. Well, okay, so what does this in fact buy us? What are some equations that we've had involving these quantities? So one equation we had was the equation of continuity, right? The equation of continuity was the divergence of J plus the time derivative of rho was equal to zero. Does that transform into a nice four-dimensional equation? And I realize that having said all of that, I should have talked about one other new way that we have of making vectors. So I'm backing up for a second. So there was another way that we had of making vectors, maybe not in 191, a little bit in 200, and for sure in mechanics, and for sure last semester in vector calculus, that was the gradient. Right? So gradients were good ways of making vectors. And you know, so kind of no surprise here in four-dimensional space, we can take things that have a three-dimensional vector, and then we want to take the derivative of these things with respect to ICT. And I know it's kind of hard to see the ICT there, so maybe it's smart to write them. 1 over I is minus I, and of course the C can just come out. So the four-dimensional vector is going to be that sort of quantity. So our book uses the notation of square to denote that process. Okay, so can I write this equation nicely in terms of four-dimensional stuff, right? Zero, this is rho, yep, charge density. This is, of course, zero is an invariant. Can I see that this is basically a dot product, that this is like the divergence of the four vector J? So let's check it out. So I'm supposed to take the divergence of the three-dimensional part, that's looking good, and then I'm supposed to take the derivative with respect to ICT of I rho C. And you can see the I's and the C's all cancel out. It's a perfectly good four-dimensional equation. We also had the Lorentz condition, which was that the time derivative of A plus 1 over C squared, the time derivative of phi, was equal to 0. That was the Lorentz gauge. I don't know if we're bothered to see it, but I think that with a little bit of thought, you can see that thing is just the four divergence of the A vector. Well, I think that exhausts the things that we've had four of, and now we have to kind of bite the bullet, right? Because we got three and three. And 3 and 3 doesn't equal 4, doesn't much equal anything that seems like it's going to be useful. So how can we make something that is relativistic and involves the E and B? Well, a hint comes about by looking at the formulas for B. So if we look at the formula for B3, for example, that's equal to the curl of A, which is going to be the 1 derivative of A2 minus the 2 derivative of A1. And that's looking a little bit like what we were talking about before, dyadics, just putting two vectors next to each other. So if this is kind of working, then this thing, 1, 2, might be the, so here's the diagonal, and the diagonal is going to turn out to be 0, so I'm putting them in early. The 1, 2 component would fit right there in that setup. So I'm hoping that this blue thing is going to be kind of generically derivative of mu of a nu minus the derivative with respect to nu of a mu. And it certainly I can put my B3 there and be perfectly happy with it. Where do the E's go in this formula? Well, so the formula we've got for example, E in the x direction was minus the derivative with respect to x of the voltage plus the time derivative of A. So this is the x component of E. We took the gradient of it, so we have the 1 component of phi. So if we use 4 vectors, the phi is going to kind of automatically come along with an I, right? Up here. And it's also going to kind of automatically come in with an over C. So what phi is just sitting there is it's the 4th component of A times C divided by I, right? So I need to get rid of that C and get rid of that I to get that guy.
A4?
Yeah, the 4th component of A.
Oh, okay.
It might be worth commenting that some people call that the 0th component of A. Depends whether you want to, if you like C, then you start your arrays with 0. If you like Fortran, you start your arrays at 1. Okay, so we know that this time derivative, if we're going to make it into a 4 derivative, we've said that the 4 derivative is the derivative with respect to ICT. And so the derivative with respect to T is IC times the derivative with respect to 4. That's a derivative. So these are two partials. Yeah, so that's IC derivative with respect to 4. I'm just trying to make this look kind of like here, where I had 1 and 2. I'm hoping to make that look like 1 and 4. Okay, so if we put all of these pieces together, what we're going to have is minus I, and then we're going to have derivative of 1 of A4 with a minus sign, and minus sign because this is a 1 over I is minus I, and then we're going to, oops, and I also wanted to pull out my C, and here we're going to have derivative with respect to 4 of A1. Okay, so IE1 over C should be the 4-1 component of this matrix. Right? So we're thinking that it should be right about there. Okay, so what I hope I've convinced you is that the that we can create this for, we can create this matrix which has zeros down the diagonal and is anti-symmetric, and it's called the field tensor. And it's kind of nice to divide off the fourth components from everything else. And we're going to have zeros down the diagonal because it's anti-symmetric. And we've seen that we had, for example, B3 here. And if we do the math, it turns out it's B2 there and B1 there. And down these sides, we're going to have, I don't have room, so we'll do it here. I've got IC times the electric field. Okay, and it's anti-symmetric, so on this part here, I'm going to have minus I over C times the electric field, three components. So what I claim is that the electric and magnetic fields are not different things. They're all part of one thing. They're all part of this field tensor. They have different units. So in order to make them have the same units, which is required for something that is all one thing, I needed to divide out this C so that everything had the same set of units.
So when you say that light column in the bottom row are all I of C times B, does that E have signs like EX and Y?
Yeah, so these three components would be X, Y, and Z. And coming down from the top. So I'm being a little bit lazy here. The B's are mixed up the way I've shown you. It's anti-symmetric, so whatever's here, it's the opposite that's there.
Is
that B3 minus B2? So this is B3 minus B2 and B1. And if you think about it, that's exactly what you would get from epsilon ijk bk. Right? If I put in 1, 2, I would get, the k would have to be plus 3. And if I put in 1, 3, then b would have to be minus. Remember this epsilon maybe a little bit. Well, so
if you had two fields set up and you chose a point in space for this four vector, you multiply that into this thing, what field models these are.
So what you're going to be doing it for in homework is the following. So let's say you know what the electric and magnetic field is in this room, and you're in a frame that's going by at high speed, what would you measure for your electric and magnetic field? So all we need to do is to transform this F tensor using the rotation matrix, the Lorentz transformation, and we can get what E and B would look like in the new frame. Yeah, so just as time and space change when you switch frames, electric fields change when you switch frames. And we could get what those electric fields would be in a new frame by transforming this guy.
So this is kind of just a way of writing both the electric.
Well, it's more than that, because this thing is not just a random set of numbers. It's a set of numbers that transforms according to the Lorentz transformation. And it turns out we can write everything in terms of these. We better. Remember I said that what we want are tensor equations, vector equations. So if this is going to be useful, I have to be able to write Maxwell's equations nicely in an invariant form for these things. And I can. So it turns out if you think about how that's going to work, if I, for example, if I took the derivative of this with respect to nu. So I'm going to go down this, column. I'm going to take the x derivative of nothing. I'm going to take the y derivative of b3. I'm going to take the z derivative of b2. And I'm going to take the time derivative of e. What is that going to generate? Well, the one derivative of z and the y and the x derivative of b2, that sounds like the curl. And if you work it out, exactly what's being generated is the curl of b plus minus mu naught epsilon naught the time derivative of e. And that's equal to the current density. Right, we're used to putting this term on the other side of the equation and calling this the displacement current. But if we just go down this row, we'd be getting that. So in fact, it turns out that so this is a good relativistic equation, the divergence of this tensor, and it's equal to mu naught times the four vector that is the current. If you look at the bottom row and we go through, we're going to get the divergence of E, and you know that the divergence of E is the charge density, right? That was our first equation. Now, I'm not going to go through the details, but let's talk about another quick application. And you remember the equation that we had for the Lorentz force? The force was the charge times the electric field plus the velocity crossed into the magnetic field. Why that crazy equation? Well, that crazy equation is that, where we take the four velocity vector and we dot it into the field tensor, we will generate exactly that equation. So we better be able to write every equation in four-dimensional form if relativity is going to be satisfied. Okay. So instead of having four vector equations for Maxwell's equations, we're going to have this guy. And the other Maxwell's equations, which are automatically satisfied for potential, they look kind of funny. I don't know if I want to bother to write them or not. Well, let me write them in a way that I'm more or less happy with writing them. So you might remember I said that the zeros that we had for Maxwell's equations, so what we had was that this equation here, and we also had an equation for induction, that the curl of the electric field plus the time derivative of the magnetic field was equal to zero. And I commented at the time, if there were magnetic monopoles, then there would be a right-hand side. And of course, the divergence of B being zero, if there were magnetic monopoles, then there would be a right-hand side. So it turns out there's what's called the dual of F. And basically what the dual of F does is it switches around the E and B fields. And I'm going to note that as F twiddle. And the other two Maxwell's equations besides this one are then simply that F mu nu twiddle is equal to zero. And if there were magnetic monopoles, then there'd be a current term just like this. Okay. Now, incidentally, we've put history on its head. That is to say, historically, what Lorentz did is find the Lorentz transformation by finding the set of transformations that left Maxwell's equations invariant. And only later did Einstein realize that that same set of transformations seemed to be deriving all of this stuff like Lorentz contraction, et cetera, that we've been talking about. Okay. So what's the point of this then? So the point is to write it in a relativistically invariant frames way so that we know that our equations are frame invariant. And we get the big bonus then, if things are relativistically invariant, then we can find out what the magnetic and electric fields are for moving systems of particles. Well, let's do that. What does the electric field look like for a particle that's going by at high speed? So I don't know if anyone has their books handy or not, but you might turn to page 574. Or not, it doesn't matter. You memorized it anyway. So what I've said, and the handout that I didn't bother to print out that's online, has you doing the following. So we've said that if we want to find out what the electric and magnetic fields look like in a moving coordinate system, all we have to do is to apply that similarity transformation to the electric and magnetic fields that we know and love, where this R is going to be a boost. If we write out what these equations are in three-dimensional notation, where maybe it's a little bit more familiar to you, you get these equations that are 2240. And I don't know, I'll pick a random one and write it down. So what we have is that the perpendicular component of the electric field in the moving coordinate system is equal to gamma times the electric field in the perpendicular direction in the original coordinate system plus the velocity of that coordinate system crossed into the magnetic field. Okay, so there are a bunch of equations like that that simply are rewriting this set of equations in three-dimensional notation. Okay, so that's your homework. It's part of your homework is to do that. And it's kind of a mess to do by hand because these matrices are moderately ugly. Just like a general rotation matrix is moderately ugly. Just a two-dimensional rotation is pretty easy, just sines and cosines. But you expand it to three-dimensional rotations and you're not so happy. But Mathematica knows how to write these boosts for any possible velocity. So you can just use Mathematica to pretty quickly calculate this and see what these components are in the new frame, and then you can rewrite them and see that what's written there is exactly what's written here in equations 2240. Okay? So the application I have in mind is to think about what the electric field is going to look like for a charged particle, charge Q say, moving at high speeds past us. And what makes this problem easy is we know what the electric fields are and the magnetic fields are in the rest frame of that particle. In the rest frame of that particle, there's no magnetic field, right? The particle is at rest. And the electric field is just given by Coulomb. So if we know what these electric fields are automatically in the rest frame of the particle, we can convert them, actually using the inverse equations to these, and figure out what the electric and magnetic fields are in our frame of reference. Well, before we try and do this with algebra, let's try and think about what the answer has to look like. So from our perspective, this charge is a current. And we should be expecting that there's going to be a magnetic field generated by that current. And roughly speaking, that magnetic field should follow the right-hand rule. So we would guess that the magnetic field is going to be coming out of the page on this side, and it's going to be going into the page on that side. And I think pretty obviously, it's going to be small if we move away from this particle in any of the possible directions. What's the electric field going to look like? Well, the more you think about this, the more you're likely to get the wrong answer. So let me first convince you of the wrong answer. Because the right answer is so easy that you're not going to be surprised by it. So you remember we showed that everything depends on the retarded position of the particle. So if the particle is here now, presumably at some earlier time it was here, and you would expect then that the fields that we would experience would be pointing away from where the particle was when it emitted those fields. How else could it work? Does that make sense? Say again? I missed the second word. Electro?
No, that would assume that fields are like they're here at one point, they're like traveling on. So all set up here.
Well, but it is. Everything is so we've done so much static stuff that we tend to think, and of course the static case is where it's been there forever, that we have a tendency to think that it's always there and always will be there. And that's not true, right? So if you shake an electron here, the electric field on Alpha Centauri that it causes is not changing at the same time. It continues to point at where the particle was as opposed to where the particle is. And only when we have enough time for light to have propagated out will it point at where the particle, you know, is currently. So if I take a charged particle here and I just move it down a meter, for some time, the electric field on Alpha Centauri is going to continue to be pointing at there, and only later will it point there. So the electric field really is emitted and propagates even under static situations, even under seemingly static situations. And of course, static situations are actually impossible, right? The electron couldn't have been there from the infinite past. So I hope I've convinced you that in any logical sense, the electric field should be pointing away from where the particle was when that electric field was emitted. And now I'm going to tell you that that's not how it works out. For clever mathematical reasons, it turns out that the electric field does point away from the current position of the particle. And I want you to recognize how crazy that is, because what I'm saying is something that is using the terms at the same time. And we know that at the same time depends on frames of reference. So nevertheless, in our frame of reference, we will think that the particle is there at this particular instant of time, and the electric field will be pointing away from the spot that we're calling there. The other thing that's going to be playing a big role is basically this factor of gamma. So it turns out that the electric field gets really strong for high-moving particles. And the electric field perpendicular to this particle is particularly big. And again, it's going to be pointing away from the current, what we think is the current position of the particle. The electric field is going to be wimpy in front and behind. And of course, what has to still we have to still satisfy Gauss's law. That is to say, if I put a Gaussian surface around the moving location of this particle, I still have to get the enclosed charge. So if the electric field is big in some angle here, it had to be small in some angle there so that it had the same surface integral. So kind of roughly speaking, the electric field is gamma times bigger than normal in these perpendicular directions, kind of a pancake that's going out in all directions. And the range in angle over which it is big is on the order of 1 over gamma. So as we look at very high,
you know, we have particles that have gammas of 1,000 pretty commonly. So we can have, particularly for electrons, we can have very compressed strong electric fields. If we look at what the electric field is like here, if you think about it, it's very much like light. Right? Because here we have a bunch of electromagnetic stuff that is moving more or less at the speed of light, because I'm thinking about the high gamma case. And if I take my electric field and I cross it into the magnetic field, I get something that's going that away. So this pancake of electric and magnetic fields that is associated with this moving particle, if you were just to, you know, glance at a piece of it, it would look exactly like a pulse of light that is coming and going by. Of course, it's not going to move at exactly the speed of light, because it is going to follow this particle along. But I'm thinking about that particle having four nines moving basically at the speed of light. Okay, questions? Well, okay, so it looks like
lunchtime.
Yes, looks like lunchtime. I can't do this in 2 minutes. And I've told you the main story, right?
So are we gonna have a help session?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. So the exam is what? We do have one more class period, so we're not done yet. Oh, so I take it that you all know the new way of doing classroom reviews?
Yeah.
You bring a PC?
What? You have to review in the class. They have to hold it up.
So you have to bring a laptop, or you could maybe go down to the labs or something like that. So obviously we'll do that the last day, since we can't do it to the second to the last day.
So when are we thinking of doing our study session, our review?
That's
on the board.
It's on the board. Six? Really?
Is that okay? Cool.
Not later? Six? Not seven? Eight? Nine? Exactly seven.
Wait, we have to go over there.
Yeah, you're coming to sleep in.
No, we're not.
No, we're not.
7 o'clock.
Yes.
Final date. Let's do it here.
You have 7 p.m. here. Okay, cool. Bye.
Cool. Bye.